Thank you, Jeremy, for that kind introduction. I noticed that after working hard on Johnston Withers McCuskey, you didn't mention that I later worked at a suburban firm on Henley Beach Road, Zafrianis, Lupino and Eckerman. That would have been too much, I suppose. Can I thank the Press Club for this invitation? I have in the past referred to the law and the justice system as community superstructure. We're all familiar with the concept of community infrastructure. Upgrading old and constructing new infrastructure is almost universally accepted as both pressing and necessary. It's easy for people to understand how new roads, bridges, ports and the like encourage and expand economic activity. In recent times, it's also been accepted that the future of mature service economies depends on universally accessible high-speed internet connections. However, it's not as obvious to many that economic growth is equally dependent on the regulatory systems which govern our society's industrial, commercial and community activities. Those systems include cultural norms, rules of good behaviour, professional codes of conduct and ultimately the law. It's those regulatory systems to which I refer when I speak of community superstructure. Funding of that superstructure is as important as funding the infrastructure. For the most part, and fortunately, most people in our community can get on with their lives, enjoying the benefits of living in a society ordered by the rule of law, seldom troubled by legal proceedings. However, it's important that when our laws are breached, or at least when a dispute arises over legal rights, that society makes available to the persons involved cost-effective procedures to ensure that right is done to secure justice. Today I wish to focus primarily on a vision of the justice system of the future. However, because Law Week seems to have attracted some media attention, I will comment briefly on a few contemporary issues. First, some comments about the administration of the criminal law. Speaking generally, and without reference to any particular case or cases, South Australia has been well served by its police force, its prosecutors, the Legal Services Commission, other legal aid agencies in the private legal profession, and its courts. In his relatively short but productive term, Commissioner Burns set the police force on a strategic road which emphasised functionality and flexibility over static structures. I'll return to Commissioner Burns and incorporate something of his vision of future policing in what I have to say about the future of courts. The point I wish to emphasise for now is that properly resourcing police means more than providing a strong presence on the street or a quick response to a crime scene. Police must also be resourced and trained to provide, in a timely manner, the evidentiary material to support the prosecution of the offenders they apprehend. From time to time, police officers express frustration at decisions not to prosecute, and, albeit rarely, sometimes frustration at decisions to prosecute. Sometimes they express frustrations at court outcomes. On the other hand, criminal law defence lawyers often express dismay at decisions to prosecute, and perhaps even more rarely, at decisions not to prosecute. Prosecutors, for their part, sometimes express frustration over the absence from the police brief of the evidentiary material they need to establish the very high standard of criminal proof, proof beyond reasonable doubt, and express frustration at the unwillingness of defence lawyers to enter into sensible negotiations to resolve matters or to agree non-contentious facts. It's important that all of these participants in the criminal justice system, prosecutors, police and defence lawyers, remember that they have distinct roles in the administration of the criminal law and attend to their particular role as best they can with the resources they have. Constructive criticism of other participants is good, but even better when accompanied by a healthy dose of self-criticism. Speaking out is good, but even better when it is accompanied by objective investigation. From the perspective of the courts, the South Australian public has every reason to have confidence in its criminal justice system, even though, as with all things, it must subject itself to a process of continuous improvement. In 1991, the Statutory Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions was created. South Australia has been well served by its directors of public prosecutions, as it was before them by Crown prosecutors. The current Director of Public Prosecutions, Adam Kimber, and his office continue that tradition of a high standard of service. Importantly, the Director of Public Prosecutions Act gives the Director, in all save the most exceptional circumstances, an independent prosecutorial discretion. The exercise of that discretion, whether to prosecute, on what charges to prosecute, or whether not to prosecute, will not always please everybody. However, few, if any, persons outside the office will ever be aware of all of the circumstances which are known to the Director. The Director must make an objective judgment on the prospects of success based on the evidentiary material provided to his office. The Director must also consider public interest questions, especially when deciding whether to accept a plea to an alternative charge. It is easy to make retrospective criticisms of prosecutorial decisions. Criminal defence lawyers, understandably, would prefer the Director to withdraw more charges against their clients and to accept pleas to lesser charges more often. I have seen no evidence that the Director or his officers make decisions of this kind whilst looking over their shoulders in fear of public or political criticism. They are made of tougher stuff. On the other hand, I have no doubt that they consult victims and consider the wider public interest before compromising prosecutions. But that is how it should be. That is the responsibility which the Director of Public Prosecutions, with which the Director of Public Prosecutions has been entrusted. A well-known matter in which I was involved as Solicitor General established that the Director of Public Prosecutions is ultimately subject to oversight by the Attorney General, who, in exceptional cases, may give directions to the Director. In my view, the Attorney General is the only supervisory authority which is necessary and constitutionally appropriate. Importantly, the Attorney General, in exercising that oversight, is ultimately answerable to the people of South Australia through its Parliament. The Legal Services Commission has a long history of providing a high standard of in-house criminal defence representation. The Commission also very efficiently administers a system for funding private lawyers to represent defendants. However, the Commission has struggled for many years, historically in fact, with inadequate funding. The effects of that historical underfunding are twofold. First, there are fewer matters which can be funded. That creates a greater burden on the courts and clogs the system. Secondly, because the level of fees which the Commission can afford to pay is so far below the market rate for legal practitioners in other fields that many good and experienced practitioners are lost to the criminal law. Many of those who continue to practice the criminal law do so out of their commitment to justice and not for the remuneration. In short, the Commission's lawyers and private criminal law practitioners work very hard to ensure that accused persons are fairly tried and, if convicted, that they have all mitigating circumstances properly presented to the court. I mention also the important work of the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement. Their lawyers deal with the most difficult of cases with even more limited resources. Reductions to their budget will also create a further burden on the Legal Services Commission, which is likely to have to pick up their clients and add to the strains of the court system. The question of the payment of legal expenses of those who are acquitted has attracted some recent attention. For those many defendants who receive legal aid, this obviously just doesn't matter. I can understand the sense of grievance that privately paying defendants who are ultimately acquitted have. Whether they should be reimbursed is ultimately a question of public policy. I make this observation, though. The criminal justice system as a whole, and legal aid in particular, is, as I've said, underfunded. Governments operate within limited budgets, and they do the best they can to balance competing demands. It is a question of public policy whether limited government funds should be diverted from the operations of the courts and from legal aid budgets to pay the costs of privately paying acquitted defendants. I make this observation on that policy question. The criminal law provides many safeguards against wrongful conviction, including a very high standard of proof. I suspect, based on my experience, that many acquittals result not from a positive satisfaction of innocence, but from the failure to meet that high standard of proof. Are the costs to be paid whenever an accused is acquitted, or only when an accused is innocent? If the latter, how are we to decide that? Whatever the community's answers to these questions, it is clear that there can only be one rule for all. No particular individual or class of defendants is more entitled to his or her costs on an acquittal than any other because of his or her position, vocation, or membership of an association. Let me turn to the work of the courts. The Magistrates Court heard 66,000 criminal matters in the last financial year, the District Court 2,923, the Supreme Court, which effectively deals only with murders, 243. All courts dealt with most matters within a year. Overall, that is a significant and substantial achievement. We can all, of course, do better. Our courts work to a comparable standard to courts all over the country. The work of the courts and the justice system in South Australia is not substandard. Interstate comparisons are particularly difficult. They must take into account the degree to which populations are distributed and are in remote communities. They must take into account policing practices, the complexity of the charges that are laid, and a number of other factors which make it pretty well impossible to compare one state to another. But if comparisons are to be made, the best comparators, or the closest comparators for South Australia, are probably, or the closest comparator is probably Western Australia. On the question of the time that it takes to dispose of criminal matters, it is primarily a function of the time it takes for prosecution and defence to prepare their cases and to negotiate. Adjournments are given at the requests of parties who want more time to do those things. Sometimes, in a very small proportion of cases, adjournments are given because there is no court available. That problem is most acute in the district court. The chief judge of the district court has established in recent times a criminal justice management forum. It discusses and exchanges views about topics and issues concerning the hearing and, in particular, the listing of criminal matters. Members of that forum include judges from both the District and Supreme Court, representatives of the Attorney General's Department, the DPP, the Legal Services Commission, the Law Society and the Bar Association. It's chaired by Judge Davison, who was in her time an experienced prosecutor. Improvements to the system and to delays will come through the hard work and rigorous analysis of committees like that. I urge all practitioners who are concerned with this problem to contribute constructively through their representatives on the committee that the Chief Judge has established. However, there remain intractable problems which are outside the capacity of the court to manage. The Attorney General has recently released a transforming criminal justice paper that makes a number of proposals for reform of the criminal procedure of the committal and trial procedures for major indictable offences. The paper emphasises the need for early resolution of serious criminal matters. I welcome the Government's commitment to improving this area of the criminal justice system. Early resolution allows victims and defendants and witnesses to put distressing events behind them. It gives them closure. Early trials will result in more just verdicts because the recollections of witnesses will be fresher. The wider community too benefits from the early disposition of criminal matters because it engenders a greater sense of security. The modification of existing procedures and the tightening of timetables in the early can assist the early resolution of matters. On the other hand, major changes in criminal procedure should be supported by strong evidence before they are adopted. There are two such proposals which, in my view, should be carefully investigated and indeed debated. The first is the proposal to empower police to lay what is referred to as a statutory charge, which is in effect an internal police decision to charge without placing the matter before a court, and it can lead to the detention or bailing of the persons they charge. The second proposal I mentioned affects a significant shift in criminal procedure. It imposes additional requirements on defendants to disclose more of their defence ahead of the trial, or at least to indicate the aspects of the prosecution case they do not dispute. There is no doubt that obligations of that kind will expedite proceedings, which is a good thing, and they will save much time and expense by avoiding expensive forensic investigations of matters about which ultimately there is no dispute. I can understand the force of the arguments that obligations of this kind can be imposed without causing any unfairness. However, I express no concluded view on either of those questions. The point that I wish to emphasise and make are that the questions are essentially matters of public policy, and it is important that they are fully explained to and debated by the community before adoption, if they are to be adopted. For the purposes of reform, though, what is needed more than anything else is the proper resourcing of police, the Office of Director of Public Prosecutions and the Legal Aid Commissions. It will be necessary to increase short-term funding of criminal justice agencies to change the prevailing culture to one of early resolution, but in the long term, ongoing costs will be reduced. A failure to properly resource any change will cause the failure of that change. The courts have also engaged in a process of continuous reform in the civil area, which I won't, in the interest of time, stay. If anyone has a burning interest in it, I will answer questions. Now, everything I have said so far has been premised on old existing practices and old technology. All of that is about to radically change. All of us here today are carrying that change in our pockets, purses, or have it sitting on the table in front of us. We call it a smartphone, but telephonic communication is but a minor function. We all recognise the way it has transformed social interactions, but we are yet to fully comprehend the way it will transform industry, commerce and government. We know that for youth it is a comprehensive entertainment package. It creates and facilitates virtual schoolyards, town squares, theatres. More seriously, it creates virtual crowds, gatherings, protests, petitions, and we saw in the last few years in the Middle East even revolutions. It is a real-time newsroom whose reporters are every user, and there are close to 1.2 billion of them. Think about how I and anyone else can find the statistic. Close to 1.2 billion of them around the world with a smartphone. Using smartphones, we access content which ranges from the works of ancient philosophers to the constitutional debates of modern democracies to the routines of comedians and to much more information. Again, we use smartphones to navigate ourselves around foreign lands and to take selfies in front of iconic landmarks to share with Facebook friends. All of this in just over 20 years. When we reflect on the transformations as massive as this, it's obvious that it would be disastrous not to embrace this technology in government and in the justice system in particular. How might all this look? Let me start with the vision of modern policing of Commissioner Burns that I referred to earlier. His vision was that the police officer's notebook would be replaced by an electronic notebook, a laptop that the police would take around with them and would have an inbuilt camera. Let me walk you through the cascading effects of a change as simple as that. An assault on a city street. I was going to say Hindley Street, but I thought that would be unfair, but given that we're here. An assault on a city street. A police officer arrives and videos the victim, her injuries and her contemporaneous statements. He videos that as she points out her assailant across the street. Other police officers videotape the statements of eyewitnesses as they stand in the street and point out where and how the assault was committed and give a description of the assailant. A police officer walks across the street and videotapes a conversation with the identified assailant, who appears dishevelled and bloodstained. The suspect is arrested and taken to the city watch house. By the time of their arrival, voice recognition software has created Word documents of the taped interviews. It will happen. This speech has been written largely by me using Dragon for the first time this week. It is extraordinary. This thing is quite possible. The arresting officer has also completed the fields on electronic templates of a charge sheet and a brief summary of the offence and the prosecution evidence. The arrested person is taken before the officer in charge of the watch house, and immediately makes a bail application. The officer scans the arrested person's smartphone and extracts telephone, email, Facebook contacts which are checked against the database and which confirms the offender's identity. The officer can now confidently grant bail but requires a guarantor. Email contact with a parent or friend allows an app-facilitated bank transfer of a cash guarantee. When the arrested person returns home after his release, he finds text, Facebook and email messages containing attachments which are the charge sheet, police summaries and notification of a court hearing date, all of which are hyperlinked to a page on the Legal Services Commission website, allowing him to complete an online application which is automatically approved by reference to his social security number. All this has now happened within 24 hours instead of months. There's a human tendency to bury your head in the sand to escape a big problem. Having help at the touch of your smartphone can overcome that procrastination which lawyers and courts see daily. The Legal Services Commission website also allows him to access a list of accredited criminal law practitioners with hyperlinked online contact details. The arrested person sends electronically to the selected lawyer the information received from the police. By the first hearing date at which the solicitor can appear online, audio-visually, or by text chat link, the solicitor has obtained instructions by a combination of online and face-to-face communications and has negotiated with police prosecutions in a similar way. The matter can be set for trial or a guilty plea can be made. And I confidently predict that many fewer matters will be set for trial. The potential for dispute and doubt when a witness is confined to distant recollections of a chaotic and distressing event dissipates in the face of real-time audio-visual records of the genuine and spontaneous reactions of the people involved to those events. Similar procedures, with some adaptation, will facilitate the investigation, charging and prosecution of more serious offences. The statements of witnesses and forensic investigations can be posted directly onto and managed on an online database which allows communications between investigators and between investigators and prosecutors so that police investigations can be focused directly on the real matters in contest. The defendant, having obtained very early legal representation, allows his lawyer and the prosecutor to negotiate an early guilty plea or to identify the real issues in dispute. What I've described is not a brave new world of the distant future. It is possible with contemporary information technology. The savings to the justice system cannot be overstated. The improvement in timeliness will be dramatic and culture-changing. Information technology has the potential to affect substantial improvements too in civil procedures. Initiating summonses can be filed electronically. They can have attached hyperlinked the essential documents which are in dispute. A building dispute might attach photographs of faulty work. A personal injuries claim may attach relevant medical reports. A contractual dispute may have the contract attached electronically. The defences too can be filed electronically, and the matter can be put before a judge who manages a special trial list which specialises in matters of that type, who can very quickly then make directions for the proper case management of those proceedings. As the matter proceeds to trial, if it does proceed to trial, lengthy documentation will be used electronically. The courts will not have to carry around files and files of hard copy from registries to judges' chambers and courtrooms. Electronic searches of the evidence will be much quicker during the trial, shortening the length of trials and saving much court time. That is something of the future which is possible, but I want to conclude by taking a very different tack and going to a matter which, in my view, is a matter of shame for the criminal justice system and for the wider community, and it has been a matter of shame for all too long. I speak of the over-representation of Indigenous persons in custody. In 2014, of the 900 prisoners held in remand in South Australia, 26% were Aboriginal. The population rate in the general population of Indigenous people is under 3%, let's say close to 3%. But remand prisoners, 26% are Indigenous. And that accords with the figures over the last 10 or so years and roughly accords with figures with our best comparators around the country. The sentenced prisoner rate in South Australia in 2014 was 366 of the 1,770 prisoners, or 20.6%. Again, a figure which is consistent over the years and broadly around the country. Of the total population, total prison population of about 2,650, there are therefore 22.4% who are Indigenous. The total incarceration rate for adult Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, that is the incarceration rate within their own population, is something like 2,500 out of every 100,000 at any given time. The rate of incarceration for youth, by youth, let's remember we mean children, are worse. A SACOS report published just earlier this year examined the over-representation of Aboriginal youth in the justice system. It found that Aboriginal youth are approximately 4% of the population generally, but comprise 46% of the children in detention. An Aboriginal youth is 12.5 times more likely to be involved with the justice system and 19.7 times more likely to be in detention than a non-Aboriginal child. The Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody reported as long ago as 1991 that the consequence of Australia's history since colonisation is the partial destruction of Aboriginal culture and a large part of the Aboriginal population, and also disadvantage and inequality of Aboriginal people in all the areas of social life where comparison is possible between them. The Australian Human Rights Commission surveyed the response of governments to the recommendations, to the Commission's many recommendations in 1996, it found that very few of the Royal Commission's recommendations had been put into effect. It is a major failure of policy in this area that there has not been a review of the implementation of the Royal Commission's recommendations since that time, nor has this question been looked at systematically since that time, but if anything, over-representation has worsened. The failure to bring the Aboriginal incarceration rate to anywhere near proportionate levels represents a continuing institutional degradation of Australia's Indigenous people. Recent cuts announced in Aboriginal legal aid funding will only exacerbate this problem. It is an ethical and social justice failing which must be remedied. Sound economics also demands its correction. The estimated annual cost, according to the SACOS report, of detaining Indigenous youth is $13.3 million annually, which would be reduced by $12 million if Aboriginal youth were only proportionately represented. If the adult prison population was proportionate, there would only be 80 Indigenous persons in reduction. If we were to satisfy ourselves even with double representation, the adult prison population would now be 2,200 odd, not 2,650. 2,200 instead of 2,600, the prison overcrowding problem goes. The need for new prisons goes. Both ethical and economic considerations demand that this problem be addressed. As we would expect, the causes of over-representation are many. They include, and they are interconnected, they include health problems, drug and alcohol dependence, mental illness, homelessness, poor education, family dysfunction, and the like. Many of these problems really can only be addressed by other agencies, not by the justice system. But the question for me and for other justice agencies is, what can we do about it? I went back to the Royal Commission's recommendations. It recommended that the operation of bail legislation be closely monitored to ensure that the entitlement to bail, as set out in legislation, is being recognised in practice. The granting of bail is essentially a risk assessment which weighs the risk that the defendant will abscond or commit further offences against the presumption that persons not yet convicted should not be denied their liberty. The principle applies irrespective, of course, of class or race. However, in practice, if a particular community group suffers a high rate of homelessness and unemployment, then bail is more likely to be refused. The Port Adelaide Noongar Court, pioneered by Magistrate Chris Vass, involves Indigenous elders in the sentencing hearing. The involvement of community elders both furnishes the court with useful information and adds an additional level of authority to the sentence of the court. Another really important benefit of the participation of the elders is that it reinforces their authority in their Indigenous communities. I believe that the role of the Indigenous community and its elders in particular in the criminal justice system can be expanded. The Royal Commission recommended that wherever possible, departments and agencies responsible for non-custodial sentencing programs should employ Aboriginal people to take particular responsibility for the implementation of such programs and should employ and train Aboriginal people to assist, to educate and inform the community as to the range and implementation of non-custodial sentencing options. It also recommended that in devising work programs and community service orders, there should be close consultation with Aboriginal communities. It recommended that home detention be provided both as a sentencing option available to courts as well as a means of early release of prisoners. It is time to revisit these recommendations. It is time to investigate the establishment of bail hostels, community correction and community corrections programs which are managed by Indigenous communities, which make use of their community authority structures and their elders in particular. Of course, such bail hostels and community corrections programs must also adopt best practice in community corrections. Their programs must be reviewed and their continuing operation must be evidence-based. But something must be done. It will be difficult to change around this chronic historic overrepresentation. There will be, no doubt, failures if we attempt the task in the way recommended by the Royal Commission. But doing nothing is simply not an option. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. We've reached the stage now where we invite questions from the floor, from the media in attendance and from other people as well. So anybody who wants to ask a question, if you could start making your way now to the microphone stand at the rear of the room. There's always a bit of a lag, so it'd be great if people could start heading up there now. Absolutely. And I think we're right to go. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask about the federal budget. There have been cuts to community legal aid. What sort of impact do you think that will have?
It depends on the community legal aid centre you're talking about. Community legal aid centres provide really important assistance in civil disputes. The Legal Services Commission does not fund ordinary civil disputes, or not many of them, if any at all. And that is the gap that has been filled by community legal aid centres, and that will affect the courts. The courts, for example, have recently introduced a service provided by JusticeNet, a community legal centre, where they provide lawyers in the courtroom so that people representing themselves who have a problem with filling out a particular form or taking the next step can go and get advice, discreet advice for that step. That helps the courts enormously because it saves our registry staff time and it saves much cost for the opposing party to have that assistance given. Of course. Let me make it completely clear. I'm not an advocate for how government, state or federal, should allocate their budgets. I recognise acutely the fiscal problems they have and the difficult job they have in balancing competing demands. The position I put simply is that it is a historical fact that the justice system has been underfunded, and I make the point that I made at the outset of what I've had to say, and that is that there are real economic benefits to the whole community in adequately funding superstructure of the kind which the legal system provides. But that's not to say that, but at the same time, funding is cut and it is going to have an adverse effect. then it's the role, I think, of the courts who are affected by it to make the point. But it's, as I say, it's not a criticism of government prioritisation. They have to account for that politically.
You've outlined a very exciting and efficient future for courts in this speech. Ahead of next month's state budget, what's your message to the government?
We have, that is the Courts Administration Authority, has put in a budget bid for an upgraded contemporary information technology system. The prospect of a new building, bricks and mortar infrastructure is gone. It is really important that we have a contemporary information technology system, and I hope that the government will give our bid for money to do that favourable consideration. The importance of general deterrence in sentencing drug traffickers has been well established for many years. It was established authoritatively by my predecessor, Chief Justice Doyle, in the case of Mangelsdorf, and the courts continue to take an approach which emphasises general deterrence. And often the personal circumstances of some of the defendants excite sympathy. Many of them actually have a lot of potential, are quite smart, a lot of potential to contribute positively, and are in lawful businesses. But there is only very limited weight which you can give to those personal circumstances, because drug trafficking and the methamphetamine trade in particular is causing great social harm, and general deterrence has to be emphasised. I noticed the increasing problem of methamphetamine as a drug shortly before, and certainly when I joined the Supreme Court in 2008, and I've noticed an increasing awareness of its harm and the need to deter it in the judgments of the court since that time.
Andrew Huff from the Advertiser for Chief Justice. Can I turn your attention, please, to the use of suppression orders? The newspaper reported a couple of weeks ago a case involving a very senior health practitioner who was awarded a secrecy order in a hearing that was held behind closed doors. Do you think there is elements of the judiciary that do not believe in open justice, and do you think there are efforts still to be made to ensure the transparency of the judiciary?
I think all judges believe in open justice. It's built into our DNA from when we start practicing as lawyers. At the same time, judges have a concern for the adverse effects of publicity on persons in certain cases. But their personal views don't matter. They apply legislation. The suppression order legislation initially conferred on judges a wide discretion, and there was some variation in approaches over the last decade, or just over more than a decade. That has been tightened. Judges simply apply those tests now. I obviously can't comment on the particular case you have in mind, but I can tell you we don't walk around in the corridors saying, drat this, you know, opening up of publication, and we don't like open justice, far from it.
Michelle Vallow with the 7 Network. Journalists fiercely guard the right to protect our sources where we receive information, very varied information from varied sources. Do you, in principle, support this right to protect our sources, and do you think the judiciary should have any respect for this? Or would a reporter who refused for any reason to not name their source if they were subpoenaed to appear at the trial that you were presiding over, would they risk going to jail if they refused to name their source before you?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I'm not on top of just what legislative change there has been on this question. I know that federally there was some legislative change introduced to protect sources. But again, this is a policy issue. The extent to which the freedom of the press requires confidentiality of sources against the requirement of the community that justice be done in a case by hearing all of the available evidence. Those two principles are in competition. The way in which they are balanced will need to be decided by legislation. The common law position is that the requirement of, as you, this is not surprising as you might expect, is that justice trumps the freedom of the press. But it's open to the government to legislate to change that common law position, and the courts will simply apply the test that appears in the legislation.
It's outside the court's direct jurisdiction, but do you feel that much more could be done for the rehabilitation of offenders in South Australia, particularly our Aboriginal brothers?
Again, I am not an advocate for the particular split of government budgets, but I think the over-representation in prison of Indigenous people speaks for itself, and it will be expensive. Rehabilitation of any offender needs to be intensive, and for that reason it is expensive. Rehabilitation programs for Indigenous people will be as expensive, if not more. The point I wished to emphasise this afternoon is that I think the court's experience with Aboriginal elders can be put to good use in rehabilitation programs, and that we should revisit the Royal Commission's recommendations that the Aboriginal community be involved in those rehabilitation programs.
Chief Justice Ken McGregor from the Advertiser. You spoke earlier this about new technologies and their ability to push court and systems through. Are you concerned about safeguards, people hacking and being able to manipulate that information for their own benefit?
That's obviously an issue, but there is technology that deals with that. I know that there are hackers constantly trying to keep a step ahead of it, but I'm not overly concerned with it because in the end, the justice system is meant to be transparent. Plainly, documents filed by parties are still meant to be effectively limited in use to their case. But our systems are, when we go to trial and in court, open. So I don't think the security question is as big a problem for courts as it might be for police themselves or defence, fairly obviously. It can, and we've investigated and are working on using technology to disseminate information about the courts. I have a particular personal concern about televising court proceedings. My concerns are twofold. First, cost, but of course if the government wanted to throw money at providing that sort of online entertainment when we're underfunded everywhere else, well, then that's a decision it might want to make. But cost is one thing. But the other area where I'm really concerned is about the effect on witnesses and counsel, and probably the judge as well, of knowing that the proceedings are being televised. I'd be worried that it would skew the way things are done.
I'm just wondering, I know the government's looking at this, but in the light of the Lindsay decision in the High Court, what do you think we need to change the publication laws in South Australia?
That is a matter of policy in a number of judgments. Lindsay was one of them, and in one or two other judgments, I've commented on what I consider the certain internal tensions and legal incoherence in the law of manslaughter. But ultimately it is a policy issue for government. I think South Australia is the only state which still has the common law provocation defence. If it is to be abolished, I think consideration should be given to whether or not it remains a matter of mitigating circumstance, if proved, which the judge could take into account and perhaps take into account to impose something less than the statutory minimum non-parole period of 20 years. So in effect what I'm suggesting is you can leave it as it is, you can abolish it altogether, or you might take a halfway house where you say, although it will not result in a manslaughter verdict, the judge, if satisfied that the provocation exists, can impose a non-parole period something less than 20 years.
Just in relation to your concerns about the way Aboriginal is treated in the justice system and your description of the shame that you're probably there, what are you actually doing about that? Have you actually spoken to the government? Do you intend to speak to the government about the need for another look at this and the sorts of ideas you play today?
Yeah. This problem is one that has recently taken my attention. There is limits on what the courts can do because of the existing sentencing options which we have, which are limited. But it having come to my attention recently, it is something that I raised in a recent conversation with the attorney, and in fact was very pleased to know that the government already has in mind what are some programs known as justice reinvestment programs, which would have money invested in supporting the communities in the hope that there in the long term would be savings. So it's an issue which I'm sure the government is aware of, but by revisiting the Royal Commission's recommendations, I was taken by the particular recommendation that Indigenous communities be involved in those programs. I don't know anything near enough about the details of the problem. I was very pleased and am very satisfied that without any previous public demand or outcry, the Attorney General's office was already looking at that issue. And that is a very positive and welcome thing, I think.
Judge recently told me, he said, I look out my window and I see the Aboriginal flag in Victoria Square, and it disgusts me. And asked me to explain why it was that Aboriginal people were allowed to fly their flag in Victoria Square. But you talk about a review.
You're going to claim confidentiality on that source, aren't you?
And you talk about a review of the implementation of the Royal Commission. What effect would that have? Given that person's attitudes, if in fact they feel that
he's important,
may not.
I'm surprised at that attitude. I'm still confident that that judge would apply the judicial sentencing discretion in accordance with legislation, and if sentencing options included rehabilitation programs, including ones managed by the Indigenous community, I'm sure that judge would act in accordance with the legislation and exercise his or her discretion judicially. And if they did not, if he or she did not exercise the discretion judicially, the defendant has a right of appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeal.
Follow-up question, please, Your Honour. There's been several commissions, Royal Commissions, that's been held into child sex abuse. Does the judiciary understand its impacts on victims of potential child abuse or sexual abuse? And do you think that the judiciary is dealing with it adequately despite some receiving systemic sentences?
I think the whole community over probably the last 30 years has been playing catch-up in understanding the spread of the problem, the prevalence and the effect on victims, but I can tell you that I'm sure the legal profession and the judiciary have actually ahead of the curve on that, because we see the pointy end, see the victims giving their evidence, read the victim impact statements and see the devastating effect offences committed when they were teenagers, if that old, as they get older, into their 40s and 50s and beyond. We see lives simply collapse because of the burden that had been carried for decades. The judiciary is well aware of it through its own experience, and in our own continuing education programs have invited guest lecturers, psychologists, people who have worked in the field of child sexual abuse and sexual abuse generally, to provide us with the latest learning and understanding on that issue.
And just one final question, personal question for you. Do you find yourself being personally impacted by the cases that you hear and the tragedy that you are confronted with on a daily basis? And given your position as the head of the judiciary, do you feel that you have done enough work to help victims and to help people that come before the courts?
Well, we can help people who come before the courts, victims or witnesses or unrepresented defendants, to a limited extent within our courtroom, within our procedures, and we do that, facilitated often by statute, audio-visual links for victims to give evidence so they don't have to be in court, one example. But this is a shared responsibility amongst many justice agencies. I'm sure, again, we can always do more and do better.
Rebecca Bonney from the Australian. Just back to child protection. Do you see the need for a children's commissioner to be created as a matter of priority to help give children a greater voice in the justice system?
Right. Well, if you're asking me whether in criminal matters victims, including children, should be separately represented, my view is that they do not need to be, and that it would create a delay and, in fact, distort the justice system if witnesses were separately represented. I think if the prosecutors, and prosecutors now, are acutely aware of the special needs of victims, that they can prosecute a case which both, in a way which both serves the public and protects the interests of the victim. So I don't support separate representation for victims in court. I understand the arguments for it. I understand the European models for it. But I think in our model it would be counterproductive. But if you're asking me more generally whether there should be a commissioner to advocate for reform generally, that's again a policy question. Again, obviously, this problem is a huge social problem. We're finding out more about it now with the National Royal Commission, of course, but anything that can help alleviate the suffering of children who've been abused and adults who then carry that on throughout their lives is a good thing.